Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with historian Ronald Drez, whose new book is The War of 1812, Conflict and Deception, the British Attempt to Seize New Orleans and Nullify the Louisiana Purchase. We'll also hear from crime novelist Bill Lofelm, whose new book is Doing the Devil's Work. And we'll check in with Sarah Woodard, executive director of STARE. Start the adventure in reading. Ronald J. Drez is a Vietnam War veteran and a former U.S. Marine captain. He's the author of many books, Voices of D-Day, Voices of Valor, Voices of Courage, 25 Yards of War, to name just a few. And he's the president and principal historian of Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours, Inc. Today, we'll be talking about his new book, The War of 1812, Conflict and Deception, the British Attempt to Seize New Orleans and Nullify the Louisiana Purchase. Ron, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you so much. Good to be here.
So, we're coming up on a very important historical anniversary, aren't we?
We are indeed, the bicentennial of the Battle of New Orleans.
Now, I think of you as an historian of more recent wars,
yes.
This is going farther back in time for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I've kind of stepped into the time capsule and dialed back 200 years because most of the work I've done has been in World War II. One deviation, I went out and did a little bit on Vietnam, but suddenly with the bicentennial coming up, Louisiana formed the Bicentennial Commission, and one of the underlying facts was to finally try and get this story right, because for the first 100 years, all the people who lived here and lived at the time knew what the battle was about. But in the second 100 years, it got exposed to revisionism. That's a dirty word.
I know. And you see this book as such a necessary corrective. So tell us about some of the misperceptions that have endured over time that you are setting straight.
Yeah, well, of course, the first and most egregious is the one that we all heard, whether we were a student or just a casual observer of the War of 1812. And that was, oh, the battle was useless. It was fought after the treaty was signed. It was a useless waste of life. It meant nothing. And all of that is completely false. And it's false to the point that everyone who even read the first sentence of the Treaty of Ghent said, this proposed treaty, which was really a glorified ceasefire, will not be affected unless ratified by both governments. And of course, that wasn't going to happen until the plenipotentiary arrived over here. But more importantly, it certainly would not have happened with a 10,000-man British army occupying New Orleans.
What are some of the other things that have endured about the War of 1812 that are wrong?
Yeah, of course, some of these falsehoods are based in partial truth. One of the big ones was that the leadership was abysmal. And for the first 2 years, 1812 and 1813, it was. We even had a commanding general, Hull, who a court-martial convicted and ordered to be shot for his terrible performance at Detroit. But after the beginning of 1814, then the leadership really took a step upward. And of course, the final 6 months and Andrew Jackson, leadership was impeccable, but there were lots of others too. So 1814 was a great year of the development of military leadership. 1812 and 13 is exactly right, abysmal.
One of the quotes I love most in this book was from Thomas Jefferson in 1803. There is on the globe one single spot, the possessor of which is our natural and habitual enemy. It is New Orleans.
Yes, yes.
It makes you remember all over again how central the city was.
It is. New Orleans was the spot on the world. And the reason for it, of course, is just its great control of everything coming out of the heartland of America down the Mississippi River. But more importantly, it was the subject of a world war. And when I say a world war, the War of 1812 was exactly that. It involved the three greatest military nations, and that was France England and Spain, and it was fought over control of the North American continent. And the gemstone of that was New Orleans.
It must have been fun for you to go back and look at this different kind of military history for you.
It was indeed. And what was even more fun was getting into the archives. And those archives, of course, are the Department of State papers, the memoirs of the plenipotentiaries and ministers writing back and forth to each other. And what was really magical about the whole thing is, as I'm reading these papers, I'm actually reading the words of the debates of Henry Clay and John Quincy Adams, and their writings back and forth amongst themselves, talking about the problems and what they're going to do. And it really was terrific. It was almost like finding the diary that should never have been read.
That's what an historian really looks forward to, you know. Now, one of the things I enjoyed most about this book is the way you give the reader the texture of life in New Orleans during that time period, what it was really like to live here and know this war was going on, like people going to mass in the cathedral. Yes. And stuff like that. And I was interested to see how Andrew Jackson set out to win over the women of New Orleans to his cause.
Yes, quite the man. Remember, the people of New Orleans were terrified as the British were coming, and they knew they were coming. Just weeks before that, they had burned the president's house in Washington, launched this attack on Baltimore, and had in the previous year terrorized the communities all around the Chesapeake Bay, the rape of Hampton at Havre de Grace. They truly were a certain section of the army that was made up quite often of mercenaries that was kill, burn, pillage, and rape. And the people of New Orleans knew that, and they were defenseless. We were a city made up of the cliché-ish melting pot. But here, that melting pot was at its zenith because we had all these local populations that really didn't like each other. Mm-hmm. And there was this animosity, and we were certainly not a trained army. And here is coming the army that had defeated Napoleon with this terrible reputation. Well, the people who were terrified the most were the women of New Orleans. And that's because they were defenseless, and particularly brought to light by the plight of the Ursuline nuns.
And they are getting so much historical interest right now. It's been a really fun thing to read all these books coming out about the Ursulines.
They richly deserve it. When Jackson came here, of course, he had just defeated the Creek Indians, which had been terrorizing the Mississippi Territory, defeated the British at Mobile, turned to Pensacola, drove the sanctuary British out of there, and then raced to New Orleans on a route that most people don't know. His route came along the Gulf Coast, up the Pearl River on the bank, crossed the Pearl River, and he makes a diagonal run all the way down to Wharton. Well, that's Covington. And then into Madisonville, and then he crosses on a packet boat to enter Bayou St. John. Well, when he comes here, this very nervous population suddenly whispers amongst themselves, Jackson's here. And so he tries to quell everybody's calms. He makes those great statements, they shall not come unless over my dead body, and mounts the balcony. And most likely for the first time in history, his speech is translated simultaneously into French and Spanish.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can see why your classes were full. So what will you be doing for this upcoming anniversary, for the bicentennial? What's the tour like for that?
Well, that's pretty neat. Of course, with New Orleans, you have to combine history with food, and food gets the better sway. You know, it's always very difficult to take a person interested in history away from a great crawfish etouffee, but you've just got to get on with the program. Well, we're going to all get together. Our headquarters is going to be the Monteleone Hotel. And we'll have a reception and a lecture. And then we begin trying to follow the path of where the army went during this three-week campaign. Most folks don't understand, but that the Battle of New Orleans was a three-week offensive. Five major battles took place. So we're going to take them to the natural spots. Actually, we're going to paddle wheel down the river to go to the battlefield itself at Chalmette. But other places where along the bayou where an approach was expected, where Jackson actually came, we're going to offer certain enthusiasts to canoe up the bayou, following in that trace. We're also going to visit all the spots that back then were Fort St. Charles, which was the main fort at New Orleans, now the old New Orleans Mint, the Supreme Court building, which, of course, then was Jackson's headquarters. So we're going to give everybody a taste and along the way enjoy the ambiance and good food.
Don't you think so many times there's this family connection or this sense of knowing someone who took part in these great events?
Yes, and New Orleans being the place that it is where few people ever leave, we have lots of folks here who had relatives on that battlefield. Mm-hmm. I myself had two relatives. My wife had one. And you can go around and people who know their genealogy will say, yes, yes, we were there.
Well, it's a fascinating book, too. We've been talking with Ron Dress, whose new book is The War of 1812, Conflict and Deception, The British Attempt to Seize New Orleans and Nullify the Louisiana Purchase. For more information, check out his website, rondress.com. You can meet him Wednesday, January 28th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. And for more information about Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours, go to stephenambrosetours.com or call 504-821-9283. Thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Lofelm is one of my favorite writers. He always has something smart to say, and he says it well. He won the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award for his first book, Fresh Kills, followed that up with Bloodroot, and is now on his third novel in the series featuring New Orleans police detective Maureen Coughlin. The series started with The Devil She Knows, continued with The Devil in Her Way, and now we have Doing the Devil's Work. And because Maureen is a New Orleans cop, the devil's work is everywhere, all around. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you, Bill.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for having me.
Well, welcome back. Now, we know you were born in Brooklyn, grew up in Staten Island, and now you're a true blue New Orleanian, aren't you?
I'm sitting here in a Saints jersey, so I hope so.
Even during this season, that's
yes,
true blue as it gets. Now, you took your time setting a book here because you said you wanted to be respectful and be sure that you knew the place. And in this book, we see Maureen herself becoming a little more at home in New Orleans. So tell us about some of the things she does to be at home here.
One of the things that's happened is what happens to a lot of us as transplants is she started to find her favorite places, her little nooks and crannies of her neighborhood and the neighborhoods around her. She lives in the Irish Channel and has found her favorites.
And she started to make some rituals out of her life here, which is, I think, another New Orleans process, you know?
Definitely. We were laughing about the Saints, but she piggybacks on that. It's the first time in her life she's been someplace she wants to fit in.
Right. Yeah. I know. That's very lovable.
So she has a Saints jersey. She goes to Parasols to watch the games with the neighborhood. And yes, her favorite places and her rituals. And she started to settle in a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But before you know it, she's in the middle of another terrible, terrible case, running up against some of the most powerful people in the city. So tell us about the sovereign citizens that are in the background of this book.
They are, unfortunately, a real thing. It's a national movement, I guess. There's no central leadership or something like that. It's a group of people who basically believe they get to decide what laws to follow and what laws not to follow. And they don't believe in the federal government. They believe the highest authority is the local sheriff. And oddly enough, the laws they pick to disobey are usually the ones that involve paying taxes, paying fines, getting permits. But they are now, according to the FBI, the number one threat to law enforcement.
Wow.
Because as with a lot of these movements, there are always violent offshoots.
And you've also settled on some of the recurring characters in the series, some of the good guys that are going to be coming back over and over again. Tell us about some of them.
Well, there's Marcus, who's a young Central City kid, I guess about middle school age. He makes a point of mentioning he's 13 now in the book.
Yes.
And he's learning to play the snare drum and march with the roots of music. There's Maureen's. Maureen kind of has two mentors. There's Preacher, her duty sergeant, who kind of teaches her the ropes of the day-to-day of the NOPD. And then there's Detective Christine Atkinson, a homicide detective who's kind of taken Maureen under her wing, because that's what Maureen ultimately decides to be.
And she's very intriguing, Christine is. So,
thank you.
One of my favorite characters. Now, you touch on a lot of really hot-button issues in this particular book. You talk about hate crimes, private details for cops, and internal police prejudice. And that's something that's really, really hard for Maureen to face. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that. When you think about police are having a really rough time these days. So what is it like to have a book defending police coming out right now?
Well, that's a tough question. It's not hard to figure out where my politics lie. Mm-hmm. You can't lean much further left without falling over. But I've noticed something, especially among the left, is a propensity to use the word cop the way other people use the N-word or some kind of racial slur. And to me, it's the same mistake. Mm-hmm. In that this one trait that people share makes them all the same. And I think part of what's dangerous about that is it removes the agency from the guilty. That Darren Wilson did what he did because he was a cop, not because he was a bully, not because he was prejudiced, not because he was bad at his job, but simply because of the uniform he wore. Mm-hmm. And I think that's dangerous for everybody.
And you explore both the good and bad sides of policing in this book, the real moral impulse to do the right thing, and also the temptation. You know, you describe Maureen on the verge of stopping a truck, and she feels this adrenaline that you describe as almost carnal. And that's the kind of adrenaline level I suspect that many police have to operate on all the time.
The Maureen books are essentially about power. Who has it and who doesn't? And what does that make you do? And what does that make you capable of doing? And I think especially for Maureen, who is a small woman, is a woman in a lower socioeconomic class, for the first time in her life with a badge and a gun and a uniform, has power over other people, over men, over large men, over men who are bullies, over men who in a different context might be a threat to her. She now has power over them. And it's definitely a temptation.
She's so strong and she's so vulnerable. And when you read these books, you hope for her, you know, you just hope.
Her heart's in the right place.
Yes. Well, of course, your heart's in the right place. We've been talking with crime novelist Bill Lofelm, whose new book in the Maureen Coughlin series is Doing the Devil's Work. You can meet him Tuesday, January 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, and you'll have another chance Thursday, January 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. That second appearance is a fundraiser for Roots of Music. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Susan. It was great to be back.
The new year, and lots of folks are casting about for ways to improve our community. One way to do that is by teaching someone to read, and one of the oldest New Orleans literacy organizations which does just that is STARE, which stands for Start the Adventure in Reading. Sarah Woodard, the executive director of STARE, is here to tell us what you can do. Welcome to The Reading Life, Sarah.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Welcome back. Now, you've been with STARE a long time, and your organization itself has been around since 1985. So what can you tell us about its history?
In 1985, there were a group of individuals in Orleans Parish who were concerned about the state of public education. They felt that children were getting passed on to the next grade. They weren't really reading the way they should be. So they formed a group to kind of look into this and came up with an idea of one-on-one tutoring in reading only and focusing on second grade, because second grade at that point and even today is a really critical time that children need to know how to read before they advance to older grades, and also for whatever subject subject they're taking, whether it's math or science or social studies. So they worked with several public elementary school principals and teachers, identified some children who could benefit from this tutoring, and started the tutoring program in 1985, as you said. And next year will be our 30th anniversary of doing this. We've served more than 6,500 children and helped them with the benefit of these wonderful community volunteers that we recruit every year to work with the children. And our tutors are folks who just love to read. A lot of your listeners are like that. And they enjoy working with young children. These kids are 7, 8, 9 years old, and kind of instilling in them their own love of reading so that these children will not only read well, but they'll love to read, which I think you'll understand, you know, and agree is so important.
Key to everything, yeah. I think. So say you're an average person who really does love to read and thinks, well, I do love to read and I do like kids, but I don't know that I'd be a good tutor. What is it they learn in this training session that makes it easier for them? What tools do you give them?
We say you don't have to have been a teacher or be a teacher, only that you love to read. So what we do at the beginning of the school year in the fall, and also now at the beginning of second semester, is we recruit and train those who want to be tutors. Our program runs in the afternoon, so people have to kind of look at their schedule, and they can come 1 or 2 afternoons a week from 3 to 5 p.m., that's Monday through Thursday, and start tutoring the child. So, for example, you come to the training session. It's a 2-hour session that tells you everything you want to know about being a STAIR tutor. We have a curriculum that's a step-by-step curriculum, so you don't have to say, oh, goodness, I can't do this. It's like a lesson plan. But you don't have to come up with the ideas of what am I going to read, how am I going to teach phonics, that kind of thing. We supply all that for you, and we train you, and then we give you a list of locations. We have 29 different tutoring locations in 4 parishes in the area. And you pick the one that's right for you. So whether it's near where you work, you get off work early, maybe on a Tuesday afternoon, and go sit with a child and work with them on reading, or you know, Wednesday or Thursday or a Monday or whatever. And that's through the end of the school year. So, you know, again, in the fall, we have tutors who started in September, and they're working with that same child one-on-one throughout the school year. And again, what we do in January is there's some children who have left our program or tutors who couldn't tutor anymore. So we're always looking for new tutors, and then we add some new students as well.
So do you need tutors in any particular places or parts of the city?
Yes, yes, we do. As I said, we're in 4 parishes, but we've placed a lot of the tutors already. But specifically right now, we're looking for tutors who live or work on the West Bank that would want to come to one of our West Bank sites in either Algiers or in Gretna. And then also in Jefferson Parish, we have several sites that need tutors. And again, it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday afternoon. So those 2 areas are where we really need to focus.
Now, what are some of your success stories? Because I know you've had some.
We have great ones. Yeah, and actually what we do, the schools choose the children based on their reading scores. So we get the information from the schools on their reading score in the fall, and then they test them again on their reading score and also their class reading grade in the spring, and we can see that every child improves on their reading score, every child. So we tell our funders and our parents and our teachers, look, this program really works. Anecdotally, we've had students who have gone through our program and then come back and they wanted to serve as a STAIR tutor to a child of their own, which is kind of fun.
That's what I love, the full circle.
The full circle. Where I run into people all the time who say, oh, I was a STAIR student 10 years ago, and they're like in college and beyond, which is a great feeling. So we know it works. The other big part of our mission is not just improving reading skills, but it's improving self-esteem so that these children who feel, oh, I can't read, I've been told I can't read, it's difficult, I can't get through a book. You know, we give them a book to read and they go all the way through it and they feel really good. I can read this book. Not only that book, I can read other books, I can read chapter books, you know, all of this stuff. So their self-esteem improves. So that's a big part of it.
So where are these sessions starting?
In January, we're going to start, I think we have 5 sessions. We're going to start on Thursday, January 8th. At Algiers United Methodist Church on the West Bank, and then go through. We have several uptown, and then we have one in Jefferson Parish. So we end at the end of January. For a full schedule, though, folks can go to our website, which is stairnola.org, or call our office at 899-0820.
And if people miss this go-around but would like to do it in the future, when's the next time they'll have a day?
In the fall. in the early fall, we do it for next semester. But we're always looking for tutors. And if you feel you can't do it, you know, this spring, just call us anyway. We'll put you on the list and we'll keep you up to date with information that's going on. We're kind of thinking about doing a summer program as a pilot this year, but we're just in the planning stage right now because we realize, you know, one of the big important issues for reading is that summer learning loss. So
right,
the children...
Right.
You know, they go to school, they leave in May, maybe, and then they've got a couple of months. And then, you know, in the fall, the schools, it takes a while to get them back up to the level where they were before. So a lot of schools are changing their calendars now, might be looking at 12-month school because of that, or certainly shortening that summer break or offering programs during the summer. And I know the New Orleans Public Library has a lot of summer programs. And we always urge parents who say, well, okay, STAIR is over. What do I do now?
That's,
you know,
the next
go
step.
To the library. Read to your child. Just keep it going.
Get that summer reading list.
Get the summer reading list.
We all have more time to read this summer.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking with Sarah Woodard, who's the executive director of STAIR, Start the Adventure in Reading. And for more information about becoming a tutor, check out stairnola.org. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Bill Lofelm, reads Roman Sahn's Doing the Devil's Work, Tuesday, January 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Morgan Malthrop discusses in Sahn's Andrew Jackson's Playbook, 15 Strategies for Success from the Battle of New Orleans to the New NOLA, Tuesday, January 6th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Keith Midkiff, author of New Orleans Besieged, discusses the Battle of New Orleans Wednesday, January 7th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Stuart Smith discusses and signs Crude Justice, How I Fought Big Oil and Won, and What You Should Know About the New Environmental Attack on America, Thursday, January 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Carolyn Cobb discusses The Music of 1812, Thursday, January 8th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Writers Group meets Thursday, January 8th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Max Berry's Lexicon, Saturday, June 10th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. David Eugene Ray signs his picture book, The Little Mouse Santi, Saturday, January 10th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Dr. Raul Llanos signs The Power of Self-Healing, Saturday, January 10th at 1 at Barnes & Noble in Metairie. And if you're looking for a New Year's resolution, consider helping a young child with reading skills with STAIR, Start the Adventure in Reading. The 2015 tutor training dates are these. Thursday, January 8th at 1:30 at Algiers United Methodist Church. Saturday, January 10th at 9:30 at the Land Building at St. Charles Avenue Presbyterian. Tuesday, January 13th at 1:30 at St. Paul's United Methodist Church in Harahan. Wednesday, January 14th at 1:30 at St. Charles Avenue Presbyterian. Tuesday, January 20th at 1:30 at St. Augustine's Episcopal Church in Metairie. To register for training, contact the STAIR office at 899-0820 or email elizabeth@stairnola.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.